Welcome to Nuclear Energy in Korea, a podcast to promote discussion of major issues and challenges in U.S. and Korean nuclear energy. I'm Alan Ahn, and I'll be your host today. I'm here with Dan Lippman, Senior Vice President with Westinghouse Electric Company. Mr. Lippman assumed his position as Senior VP in 2009, and prior to that he was Senior Vice President, Nuclear Power Plants, and was responsible for managing the global deployment of new reactors. Mr. Lippman, it's an honor to be speaking with you, and thank you very much for being here.
감사합니다.
Just to begin, I understand that your responsibilities as Senior VP at Westinghouse range from technological innovation to quality assurance to improving environmental health and safety. There certainly seems to be a lot of diversity in your duties with the company. How would you describe your current role with Westinghouse?
Well, currently I'm on loan to the Nuclear Energy Institute, largely because of my background in international nuclear commerce. In running the new reactors business, on the one hand, as you said, and also in running the supply chain and quality assurance and other corporate activities, I've had the opportunity to work globally. And NEI has really been stepping up its activity to promote U.S. exports, U.S. companies doing nuclear business overseas. And, of course, that requires a lot of government interface and indeed some legislative and regulatory reform.
Sure.
So I'm down here on a loaned basis in order to help NEI with its important activities.
Prior to your current position as vice president, you also played a key role in securing AP1000 contracts in the PRC. Mm-hmm. And you were also the president of Westinghouse Asia, mm-hmm. Where you were responsible for China, South Korea, and Taiwan. Mm-hmm. How important is this region for Westinghouse, and what is Westinghouse's grand strategy in Asia?
Sure. I think that the Asia area, so Northeast Asia, Taiwan, Japan, and Korea, as well as South Asia, including not just India, but as I move east and look at Malaysia and Vietnam, are very, very important to Westinghouse, indeed to all U.S. nuclear vendors. The reason being is that there is a tremendous growth in nuclear power underway and planned, and I think it was largely led by Korea and Japan, followed by China, and you're starting to see that activity pick up in a big way in other countries. So therefore, any commercial business is going to want to follow the money, and that's where it is right now. It's in Asia.
Well, on the topic of Asia, Westinghouse has had a very long relationship with South Korea, dating back to Korea's first nuclear plants, which were purchased from Westinghouse as turnkey projects. And mm-hmm. you said that you had a very personal relationship with Korea dating back to your beginning of your career with Westinghouse. How has the Korea-Westinghouse relationship evolved over the last few decades?
Sure. It's been a very interesting story and a very interesting evolution. As you said, I had lived in Korea actually starting with the second nuclear unit, Korea Unit 2. Okay. And I lived in Wole for about a year. And I've seen this relationship evolve from turnkey, where the Korean scope was rather limited, to now a situation in which the localization of Westinghouse technology in the Korean industry has really given Korea complete self-sufficiency in its domestic program. Recently, really, the Westinghouse scope is limited to the provision of instrumentation control and certain key mechanical components. And it's evolved even beyond that into what I would say is a much more of a partnering relationship. And let me tell you what I mean. So now Korea is in Westinghouse's supply chain. Doosan has supplied significant, very large components to Westinghouse for U.S. nuclear customers. You mentioned my role in China with the AP1000.
Yes.
Well, the steam generators and reactor vessels were negotiated also with Doosan. And there are a variety of other Korean mechanical contractors like BHI and TSM and other, these are mostly companies in the greater Changwon area, that are subcontractors to Toshiba, our parent company. So we have now a situation in which Korea is a very important part of the global nuclear supply chain. And the last part, maybe the latest evolution, is Westinghouse partnership with Korea in third countries. I mentioned China, but I also now look at the United Arab Emirates. And in the Emirates,
yes,
as you know, KEPCO received the award for that set of large number of units called the Baraka plant, or set of plants, and Westinghouse will be supplying a lot of key components as part of that contract. Yeah. So when you look at this, and I look at this over I just passed 30 years with Westinghouse, and I look at it as a young guy, here we were building turnkeys, and now it's a real global partnership. So I know that's a long answer, but the point is I've really seen over 30 years a major shift and partnering in the overall relationship.
How would you describe the interconnectedness between the two nuclear industries today of South Korea and the U.S. in general?
Well, clearly I would say it's characterized by interdependence. I think that Korea depends on Westinghouse for technology innovations. I think we lead the world in terms of the application of nuclear technology, and the Koreans have been the beneficiaries of that. They've developed their own technology, and as I said, given Korea's role in the supply chain, there's really significant interdependence. We depend on Korea for certain key components, and I think we like that. You know, the pricing is good, the quality is world-class, and Korea is very, very well-respected by American utility customers and by European utility customers as well.
How does Korea, the Korean energy market, fit into Westinghouse's global vision?
Well, I would say we have a limited participation in the domestic Korean market.
Okay.
We supply only certain components and advanced instrumentation and control. And that latest contract was Shinkori 3 and 4.
Yeah.
I personally was engaged in that. And we want that relationship to continue. We want to co-manufacture, we want to partner, and we think that sort of balance is very important, that Westinghouse should continue to receive certain contracts for Korea.
Back in early June, you testified at a hearing on the U.S.-Korea alliance outlook in front of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. I believe this was the Subcommittee on Asia and the Pacific. And as part of your testimony, you said that the global commercial nuclear market is quote-unquote large and growing, which seems to run counter to the opinions of a lot of people who think view the nuclear industry, the global nuclear industry, with doom and gloom, particularly after Fukushima. So what do you mean by large and growing?
Sure. So post-Fukushima, certainly certain countries made decisions to abandon nuclear. Chief among them were Germany,
yes,
Italy, Switzerland. But the rest of the world really continues to embrace nuclear energy. Now, why is that? Because the same imperatives pre-Fukushima are still there, such as the science on global warming, the need for clean air energy, the elimination or reduction of the use on fossil fuels, coal in particular, and the need for energy security and technology independence. Those are, when I traveled all around the world, those were the major drivers for countries to embrace nuclear energy. Some countries it was more one than the other, okay? But the bottom line here is those things haven't changed post-Fukushima. So my view is, particularly based on what I told you about the Asia market, but Asia, Eastern Europe, Latin America, and the Middle East still are driving very, very significantly towards embracing nuclear energy. And let me not forget, the U.S. nuclear market is currently building plants in South Carolina and Georgia. And once economic growth ticks back up in this country, there is no question in my mind that new orders will be received for new power plants in the United States, particularly in the Southeast United States.
Going back to your testimony during the hearing, Your main contention was that it was absolutely necessary for the U.S. ROK 123 agreement to be renewed in a timely fashion on the basis of a number of grounds, but perhaps most importantly, in your opinion, for economic and trade reasons. And I believe you touched upon this a bit earlier as well, but you categorize U.S. ROK nuclear trade into three main areas. Could you talk about these areas more in depth?
Sure. Well, I talked about the third area. Actually, I talked about two of the three areas already. I mean, the three areas involve the export of not just Westinghouse goods and services, but U.S. goods and services related to nuclear into the Korean nuclear program. So not just Westinghouse, but a number of other companies, many of whom are members of NEI, continue to have a good Korea business. So that can only take place within the confines of a 123 agreement. Mm-hmm. The second area, of course, I also mentioned, which is the provision of Korean-made components into the U.S. It's unknown to me. I'm not an attorney by training. But in the absence of that agreement, whether those imports into the United States are still okay or not, mm-hmm. We wouldn't want to jeopardize them because those are important to Westinghouse's customers and other members of NEI. And the third area we talked about was the third country aspect. So UAE and China, where depending on who has the lead role, either KEPCO or Westinghouse depends on the other to help them be more competitive. Those are the three areas that I think are characteristic of the Korea-U.S. nuclear commercial relationship. And so the provision of a 123 agreement is very, very critical to continue to allow those economic ties to continue to exist. We Sure. wouldn't want to do anything to jeopardize that economic trade.
Now, obviously, creating jobs and the economy, they're at the forefront of Americans' priorities, concerns currently. And during the hearing, you said that if we let the agreement with Korea lapse or expire, other countries would step in to fill the void, and that would be, and I quote, like taking food out of our mouths. Could you speak more on what you meant by that?
Sure. This is hypothetical. And by the way, my co-witness in the testimony, Dr. Victor Cha,
yes.
former Bush administration official, also really underlined this. If the agreement were allowed to expire, there is no question that other companies from other companies are ready to supply the Korean nuclear industry, mm-hmm. from France, from Russia, from other places. So we would not want to jeopardize that ability for U.S. companies to participate in the Korean market. That's for Korea itself. The growth markets, as we discussed earlier, are in other parts of Asia and the Middle East. And without a 123 agreement, U.S. company participation in Korea export projects would be very, very difficult, if not impossible. Mm-hmm. Again, not being an attorney, I can't speak to it. But you really want to keep this very successful 30-year framework in place and going in order to keep the bilateral trade arrangements in nuclear viable.
The negative impact on American jobs and the American economy, the nuclear industry in America, is that quantifiable? How many jobs, how much money are we talking about here?
Well,
possibly at risk.
Yeah, sure. So I can speak to the Westinghouse
sure.
jobs, and I can speak only generally to other companies.
Okay.
And I don't know exactly for other companies, but except for one company who gave me some information in preparation for the testimony. Westinghouse and its subcontractors have about 2,000 jobs directly tied to exports into Korea or to third countries. That number gets bigger when you look at indirect. So, for example, if you have a machine shop and you're supplying components to me, you may be able to tell me how many people you have working on a particular project that's destined for Korea.
Mm-hmm.
But you have sub-suppliers, too.
Yeah.
And I don't count those numbers. Perhaps you don't count those numbers. So I want to say the numbers I'm giving you are minimum. The other thing is a Converdyne, which is a fuel cycle conversion specialty company.
In Illinois.
In Illinois, exactly. They have several hundred jobs, not all of which are related to Korea trade, but many of which are related to Korea trade. When someone works in a processing capacity, they process uranium. They don't know if it's Korea uranium going for Korea or the Middle East or somewhere else. So it's difficult to separate that out. The point I want to make, Alan, is that there are significant U.S. jobs that we know about, a number more that are indirect jobs. But, you know, that's just one side of the story. Don't forget, if there are imports into the United States or exports from Korea, not just to the United States, but into other third countries like we have for China,
sure,
that means there are Korean jobs at stake too.
Okay.
And so there are Korean workers in Changwon and in other places with Hyundai near Haeundae. You know, those are large factories that also support U.S. nuclear exports. And so those are potentially in jeopardy too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just American jobs, it's Korean jobs, and I think your listeners should appreciate that.
Okay. One of the things that I received from your testimony, or something that you mentioned, was that there are long lead times, that components and the like have to be ordered years in advance, and that if the U.S.-Korea 123 agreement is not renewed expeditiously, some of the long-term contracts that now exist between the U.S. And Korean firms may be in danger. Could you talk more about these immediate-term costs of failing to reach an agreement?
Well, sure. Let's talk about the long lead things. So sure. I mentioned earlier that Doosan supplies reactor vessels, reactor vessel internals, and steam generators, some of the largest components that are in nuclear plants. We had to contract with Doosan in 2008 or 9, I can't really remember exactly when, for a plant that's going to be operational in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
We had to contract in 2007 for the Chinese components with Doosan for delivery about now.
Now.
Okay. So you see there's a
Years in advance.
So because we don't know the status of those exports to China, and of course the imports into the United States, if this agreement were allowed to lapse, I stress, not being an attorney, I don't want to opine on what the legal ramifications are for failure to ratify. You know, those are very important contracts that need to continue through delivery, and that's very, very important. And that's probably an answer to your question about what are some of the implications. Longer term than that, it is that other countries will step in to supply U.S. goods and services to the Korea industry with respect to the exports when a 123 agreement is allowed to lapse, and that's just bad.
Well, we've talked a lot about the deep economic ties between the nuclear industries of Korea and the U.S., but there are other dimensions to this relationship as well. What are the other aspects of the U.S.-ROK nuclear energy relationship? For example, collaboration on nuclear safety and security, especially post-Fukushima.
Yeah, that's a great question, because certainly the safety of the operating fleet everywhere in the world is of the utmost importance to us in the United States, and I think to the operators globally. We're, as an industry, we're only as strong as the weakest link. And we believe that the safest operating practices, procedures, and regulatory environment really emanate here in the United States. And our ability to continue to cooperate with technology transfer, with the establishment of best practices, with being able to sit down and discuss with our Korean counterparts what the latest modifications, innovations, and technologies are, is very, very important. And I think you're aware that in Korea, there was sort of a scandal in plant operations at, at one of the plants. And it's really related to nuclear safety culture. It's related to how you address and how you engage in your operating environment. And these kinds of things are important to us all. So having these agreements in place are very, very critical for the free exchange of nuclear information and nuclear technology, best practices, processes, and procedure. That's just good for everybody.
in addition to the economic benefits, the U.S. also views the 123 agreements as, I would say, a means to preserve American leadership in nuclear energy worldwide. They allow the U.S., as you said, to set standards for safety, security, nonproliferation globally. What are the risks that this leadership, this influence erodes if these agreements lapse or are not renewed in a timely fashion?
Sure. I mean, the simple answer to this is, if we're not engaged in a particular market, we as American companies, mm-hmm. not just Westinghouse, but also General Electric, for example, and other suppliers and architect engineers and constructors, if we're not involved in a particular market, then influence is lost.
Mm-hmm.
Information is lost. The ability to exchange knowledge and best practices is lost. So it's not just about commercial market access. Your question really involves the ability for the U.S. to participate in the growth
mm-hmm.
and in the evolution, just like we have in Korea, of how that nuclear industry progresses.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look at Korea as a shining example of what happens when there's a close nuclear trade relationship. Nuclear has been a thriving industry in Korea, and Korea is now world class
mm-hmm.
with respect to that. I believe that's a model that applies to many other regions and countries within them. Whether it's the Middle East or Southeast Asia, where nuclear hasn't developed to the extent it has in Korea, U.S. participation in these markets is really critical.
Going beyond just the 123 agreement between the U.S. and Korea, would a failure in negotiations between the U.S. and ROK have any impact on other 123 agreements the U.S. has with other countries? What would be the effect on the American nuclear industry overall?
Well, that's difficult to say because these are generally, and I think properly, addressed
mm-hmm.
on each country on its own merits.
Mm-hmm.
As on a pragmatic approach.
Okay.
So these are not necessarily linked. So what happens in Korea isn't necessarily what happens with Vietnam or Jordan or so forth. But generally speaking, a pragmatic, fact-based approach on a country-by-country basis is a good way to address these 123 agreements. So you can't say if this weren't renewed in Korea, it would have a knock-on effect everywhere else.
Okay.
However, there is some degree of linkage. I mean,
okay.
even though things are unique, the issue of pyroprocessing
mm-hmm.
is a very much Korea-specific issue. My view is, however, that when we as a government establish a track record of successfully and speedily negotiating these agreements, that sets the tone for the next country in line, and the next one, and the next one. So to the extent we do these quickly and appropriately and successfully, it's just good for the U.S. government. It's good for the relationship between our country and all the other countries who wish to have a nuclear relationship bilaterally with the U.S.
If I'm not mistaken, I believe there's also a renewal for a 123 agreement with China that's
yes.
also coming up.
That's right.
And so I've heard that if there's a backlog with this current 123 agreement with Korea, that may actually have a pushback effect on the Chinese agreement as well. Is that correct?
I don't know that to be true,
okay.
but I will say that there aren't a lot of people in the U.S. government that negotiate these things.
Mm-hmm.
These are technical, these are specialized, they require subject matter expertise, and there's not a lot of people in the State Department in particular, but in the U.S. government in general, that specialize in this kind of negotiation, which is unique. So that's another good reason to do things like clockwork, if you
mm-hmm.
will, because you want to be able to learn from one negotiation to the other, and you want to be able to handle these things.
Going back to what you had talked about with regards to Korea and the U.S. on third country export markets, the UAE. So when we're talking about the UAE deal that Korea has, and that would be a boon for the U.S. and Westinghouse in particular, what role is Westinghouse playing in the UAE reactors, and what are the economic benefits for the U.S. in this deal?
Sure. So the contract is worth in the billions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say so specifically, but it's a very large contract. It involves several scopes of supply. It involves nuclear fuel. It involves instrumentation and control, which is the control systems and information systems that are used in the plants. This is an area where Westinghouse is really world-class, fuel and instrumentation and control. And then it also involves the provision of turbine generator components from Toshiba.
Okay.
So it involves what I'll say mechanical, electrical, and instrumentation on the nuclear and non-nuclear parts of the plant. It's very large. And it involves, I think, the range of capabilities from U.S. industry. That's really the scope of work here.
Given how closely tied the global nuclear industry is across national borders, to what degree or sense is Korea a partner of Westinghouse and also a competitor for Westinghouse?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned in the earlier part of our discussion, this evolution mm-hmm. where Korea was just completely a recipient of technology to now being very much in a partnership mode, I would say it is true that they are both a partner and a competitor. I think there was a book written about this. It's called Coopetition.
Okay.
So we cooperate and we compete. And that's okay. We accept that. Westinghouse's business model is to transfer technology and help to nurture and grow nuclear industries in other countries. It's clear that that eventually results in a competitive environment. It's been that way with France for a long time, who have used Westinghouse technology. It's now true for Korea. It will be true for China. So the response by Westinghouse is really to essentially continue to innovate and innovate and innovate so that we always maintain a technology leadership position. Mm-hmm. But it's okay that our partners and friends compete with us as long as it's done fairly and legitimately. We accept that as part of the competitive landscape, and we welcome this type of relationship with the Korean industry because they are a partner and they are a competitor, but it's important to do that on a fair basis and to maintain a supplier relationship as well that's bilateral. Mm-hmm. As well as a competitor relationship when it's necessary.
Well, Mr. Lippman, this has been an absolutely informative and interesting discussion. Gabby would also like to give special thanks to NEI and Mr. Eric Mackerlane for the opportunity to conduct this interview. Mr. Lippman, thank you so much for your time today.
안녕히 가세요.